WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. You're listening to a special collaboration with WBEZ's PrisonCast project. This is the 3rd in a trio of conversations on this podcast, all about the election from the perspective of people currently and formerly incarcerated in Illinois. If you look back on the Reset podcast feed, you'll find conversations digging into what incarcerated people want this election and what civic engagement looks like behind bars. And in this episode, we dive into what losing your right to vote looks like and what it would take to get it back. When we visited prisons and jails ahead of this program, there was one issue people like Dwayne McCoy kept talking about.
I would like to have a voice in who my president would be for my kids, for my daughter. So that's why I think civil engagement and voting for people in prison is very important.
Most people in Illinois jails can vote because they haven't yet been convicted. But when you're serving a sentence in prison, Illinois is one of 48 states that revokes your right to vote. Now there's a movement in the works to change that. We sat down with Jimmy Soto, who spent 42 years in prison in Illinois before being exonerated. In a new federal lawsuit, he's suing Chicago and the police for $200 million. We were also joined by Christina Rivers, professor of political science at DePaul University and coordinator of the DePaul think tank inside Stateville Prison. And rounding out our panel was Frederic Desrosiers, policy manager with the group Chicago Votes. I began by asking Professor Rivers a question we heard from people inside, like Joe Stack at Sheridan Prison, west of Chicago, who wonders why people with felony convictions lose their right to vote in the first place. So I asked her to start us off with a brief history lesson.
These laws have deep roots. They go back to the ancient Greek democracy, where the perception was, the idea was that those who committed harm against society would essentially temporarily lose what they refer to as their civic personhood as part of their punishment. To my knowledge, these were never permanent punishments, and they were never really that pervasive. This concept of felony disenfranchisement made its way up to the colonies. Here in the U.S., were embedded into most state laws. And they really proliferated in the South after the Civil War during the Jim Crow era and became one of the most effective methods of suppressing the black vote in the South as they worked in tandem with the criminal legal systems in those areas.
Jimmy, why do you believe it's important for people who are incarcerated to have the right to vote?
Well, for one, we're counted in the census, and they use that as a way to get funding and other programs, whatever district the prison may be in. But we have no voice in it. We're locked out. We're excluded. And I think it's important because so much of the legal system affects our everyday life.
You know, as we mentioned, 48 states don't allow people in prisons to vote. And I can imagine that some people listening right now might think disenfranchisement is one of the known consequences that you face if you're convicted of a felony. What is your response to that, Professor?
I think my immediate response is there's still so much misinformation. Some seems to be mindful, others not, just about the right to vote and voter eligibility in this country.
What do people get wrong?
That felony disenfranchisement is uniformly permanent across the U.S. In fact, it's a real patchwork of laws. Different states, because of the 10th Amendment, can handle this in different ways. There's nothing in the Constitution compelling these laws. And so there's as much variety in voter disenfranchisement and gaining re-eligibility across the states. And so it's really easy to get that confused from state to state. What stands out to me the most is there's misinformation and misunderstanding, in my experience, across economic sectors, across people, depending on, I've had conversations about this in rooms full of people with PhDs in political science. So there's a real pervasive lack of information around these laws, both in terms of how they exist, but also how they started.
So we talked to someone who's currently incarcerated, Talib McDonald, in Sheridan Prison, who argues that re-enfranchising people in prison, which is giving them the right to vote, might reduce recidivism.
How can someone be restored to useful citizenship if they're not allowed to operate as citizens? So if you got someone incarcerated, a captured audience, so to speak, this is the perfect time to teach them. This is your responsibility. And once you start getting people to think responsibly, then maybe they'll start to act responsibly.
Frederick, I see you nodding your head there. Give us your thoughts on what Talib had to say.
Yeah, I think he's exactly right. I think that the idea of restoring the right to vote to people who are incarcerated connects them with their community, right? And so if you are a part of your community, you see yourself as a part of a community, you're less likely to harm your community. We know that people who are incarcerated still have connections. Most people who are incarcerated will go back to their communities. They're not going to be there forever. They have a stake in it, whether they have kids, family members, about they want to see when they return. And so I think he's exactly right. People who feel connected to their community are less likely to harm others and less likely to go back to prison.
So, Frederico, I want to hear more from people in prison. We did get this question from Patrice, who's in Joliet, and she asked about the status of legislative efforts focused on allowing voting from prison. I know that you have lobbied in Springfield trying to bring awareness to the issue. So tell us more about what you heard from politicians.
Yeah, throughout Illinois, there is a lot of legislators who support this. They want to see this happen. There is a lot of pushback from more of the moderate Democrats who I think are concerned about politically what it will look like in their district. But this legislation has been going on in different forms for many years. Chicago Votes has been working on it since 2021. The closest we got to passing the legislation was also in 2021, where the bill fell short about 3 votes needed to pass to the next chamber. So we have different iterations that come out every time the session ends. Currently, we're working on a bill, the Reintegration and Civic Empowerment Act, also known as the RACE Act, that would expand civics education in prison. I'm sure we'll talk about that, and Brian talked about it a little bit as well. It will also restore voting rights to people who are incarcerated.
Go ahead and tell us more now.
Yeah. So basically what that bill does is it relocates the civics courses that Brian talked about to the beginning of people's sentences. Mm-hmm. Before it was only available for folks who towards the end of their sentence. So it would make that available for everybody. We considered it would still be peer taught. And it would also have re-enfranchisement language that would allow people who are incarcerated in Illinois to get their right to vote back after a short period of disenfranchisement, which is required by our Illinois Constitution.
Right.
But it's not defined on how long that period has to be, which makes the Illinois legislature have the authority to restore it earlier if they choose. And so we're hoping that they will choose that and pass the bill.
Interesting. So, Jimmy, right now, what do you see as the biggest obstacle in this push to give incarcerated people the right to vote?
I think it's educating the public. A lot of the public, like Professor Rivers pointed out, have a misunderstanding of what really the disenfranchisement is all about, because what it really is, it's judicially made. Our Constitution, our state Constitution in Article 1, Section 11 says they have to restore the offender to useful citizen. As Talib alluded to, you're taking that away. You're not making me into a useful citizen if you exclude me out of the process of voting. So I think that civic engagement is important to make the person whole again, because so much of the system makes you dehumanized, and this is a way of giving you back your personhood. I don't think it should be that way. And people think it's, like she said, universal, and it's not.
So, Professor, realistically, I mean, is this something that you see happening anytime soon?
Yes. I think we're getting close here in Illinois, and I'm really, really proud of Chicago Votes and of our incarcerated partners at Stateville and elsewhere who have really been helping to push for this type of this law. One thing I wanted to point out, and I know, Jimmy, you wanted to get to this as well, but related to the misinformation, which I think is getting better now, but we still need to do a lot more yelling from the rooftops, is that, you know, the U.S. is seen and puts itself out there as the first modern democracy, right? But we're the only one of our peer democracies that automatically disenfranchises people as part of a felony conviction, besides the UK. And of course, we come out of that system. So we're really an outlier as a leading democracy in the amount of people that we disenfranchise, mm-hmm. Because in part we're an outlier in that we incarcerate more people than most of our Democratic allies. And so I think that's a piece of information that really, really needs to be put out there, is this is a way in which we stand out in a way that runs counter to our commitments to democracy and to equality for that matter.
Your thoughts, Frederick, on the obstacles in the way of getting us to having incarcerated people have the right to vote?
I would say that there's a lot of stigma and public perception that needs to change. I think that we can tend to see voting as a privilege instead of a right that everyone should have. I think that there is also just kind of, in some ways, a lack of political will from lawmakers who I think need to see this as more of an extension of this is the next vestige of the civil rights movement. People who are incarcerated are the last remaining group of disenfranchised people in Illinois. And I think that if we're serious about, you know, righting the wrongs of racial injustice in the past, that they would be willing to take this step.
Mm. So you have called the right to vote in prisons a racial justice issue and a women's issue. And the head of Illinois Environmental Council has also called this an environmental issue. Explain, Frederick, how can it be all of those things?
For a racial justice issue, as Dr. Rivers alluded to, we see a lot of these felony disenfranchisement laws pop up after the 15th Amendment, 13th, 14th Amendment, that gave political power to black people. And so we see in Illinois in 1870, the same year that the 15th Amendment was passed, is this the first time we see these kind of laws pop up in Illinois. It's also a women's issue for a number of reasons. 80% of women who are incarcerated are mothers. They should have a right to vote on the decisions and the lawmakers that affect their children, like school boards, things like that. It's also an environmental issue. I think almost every single prison in Illinois has failed the clean drinking water test. There was outbreaks of Legionella in prison. Mm-hmm. Just so many different environmental impacts and terrible prison conditions that are allowed to perpetuate because people in prison don't have any elected officials that they can hold accountable through voting.
Right, yeah. People in prisons are subjected to pollution and poor air and water quality. But as you said, Frederick, can't elect lawmakers to do anything about it. Mm. From your perspective, Jimmy, how do the results of elections like this upcoming one affect incarcerated people directly?
I think it directly affects them because of the appointment of justices by the president. And it also affects them by the elections of the judges. Like, for example, in Cook County, we probably have a good maybe 15 judges that were ranked poor by the Illinois Bar Association. But the public, again, is not educated on that. And that directly affects someone trying to put in some type of collateral petition. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at the federal level, the federal justices, they're the gateway to our federal habeas corpus relief and or our 1983 civil complaints about conditions, et cetera. So that's how it directly affects us.
What comes to mind for you on that one, Professor? The direct impact.
If we don't have enough time in the day. I'm going to come at that question a little bit differently because I've been thinking about this as we've been talking. And in some cases, the momentum is there with respect to civic engagement on the part of people with a felony conviction that we don't hear about. And so as you were talking, I was thinking of how important it is that we know that this law that we are now seeking to adjust, the Reentering Citizens Civic Engagement Act, was written by incarcerated people. This was their idea. It was written at Stateville Prison, and it has worked and is working well. And I'm learning more that there are many other acts of civic engagement, legislative activity across the state by people who are incarcerated mm-hmm. or by people who were incarcerated. And these are laws that are largely around equality, whether it has to do with criminal laws or voting rights or conditions, in some cases in labor laws. Indiana Women's Prison has a really good legacy of writing local laws related to labor. So a lot of this is already happening. And so it really flies in the face of both scholarly and public notions that people with a felony conviction, whether they're currently serving their sentence or not,
yeah.
are politically apathetic. And so that might not be the direct answer to your question, but it's what I was thinking about as we've been having this discussion. And I really want to put that out there.
Important thought. Another man at Sheridan, Carrell Weeks, suggests voting could be a part of rehabilitation.
I didn't know how important voting was until I understand what accountability was. And that was only by recognizing the pain that I caused another family. You understand? So I believe voting is important, not only for my own family, but to just show that we are people. We have hearts just like anybody else have a heart to want protection and everything else.
Jimmy, now that you have been exonerated and released, how do you think about politics and voting ahead of November 5th?
I think it reinforces the idea of freedom and democracy because in there, like I said, we were excluded from having the right to vote. And so now I can exercise that right. And it lets me know that I am free. I am able to go in there and, you know, check the ballot who I want to see elected.
Yeah. You know, we heard from a lot of people inside who couldn't vote but talked to their families about voting. While the fight for reenfranchisement continues, what are ways that people inside can make their voices heard in the meantime?
As Professor Rivers pointed out, we took the initiative to try to formulate legislation. For example, with Parole Illinois and the PNAP, the Prison Neighborhood Arts Project, we had a think tank. There was a DePaul think tank, and we collaborated to come up with our own legislation to say we need parole back in Illinois. And so that's a part of being involved in the electoral process by saying, going to the legislators, and they would come in. And oftentimes, they left educated mm-hmm. by us as opposed to them bringing a message to us.
Quick last word from you, Frederick.
I would just want to highlight all the amazing work that people have done for this legislation and for this work from inside of prison up until the closure of Stateville last month. They have been consulting and leading on this work, and we are just the arms on the outside. So just want to thank them for all of their contribution and know that we're doing this because of their work.
That's Frederic DeRosier, who's policy manager with the group Chicago Votes. Jimmy Soto, who's one of the longest serving exonerees in Illinois history. And we've also been talking with DePaul political science professor Christina Rivers. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Lauren Frost, Alex Keefe, and Meha Ahmed, with assistance from Ari Mejia, who also mixed the podcast. Reset brings context to breaking news. If you're interested in hearing more, you can check out our entire catalog of interviews at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely